This week on the show, Jared Weiss from The Athletic joins us to preview Celtics Sixers. We catch up on the Bruins playoff run, and we recap the Patriots NFL draft. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome, welcome. This is Calling It, powered by CLNS. Alex Barth, Alex Lubowitz with you in the midst of not one, but two playoff runs in the city of Boston. Who's got it better than us, Lubowitz?
It's a great time to be a Bostonian.
It really is. It was starting to get nice out till it started raining today. 83, I think, on Wednesday.
Yep. I'm trying to do something big. It's going to be a good day.
Is it too cliche that we open every single one of these shows by talking about the weather? I feel like we started doing that.
People like to talk about like weather talk and small
nice
talk.
Nice weather we're having like, today.
Oh, really great conversation. You know what? It's fun to talk about sometimes, and it's a good way to interact. It's an excuse to be like, hey, I'm a person, you're a person. Let's say some stuff to each other.
Well, look, I had to keep calling you out when you jinxed us on the snow.
Yeah.
Like, that was beyond weather. That was just keeping you accountable. And now, I don't know, I'm excited about golfing. But enough about the weather. Let's get into the content. We'll start on the hardwood. We're not going to get into specifics just of game one because we're recording this on Monday, and in case people listen Tuesday or Wednesday, we don't want it to be dated, but let's do a little Celtics Sixers preview. We are now joined on the phone by Jared Weiss. He covers the Celtics for The Athletic. Jared, right out of the gate here, the question on a lot of Celtics fans' minds, Jaylen Brown had that injury in Game 7. What's the latest you're hearing on him?
So he was doubtful as of yesterday. He told Brad Stevens he's feeling a little bit better today, and Brad said, I have no idea what that means. So it seems like he's still doubtful for tonight's game. That can change in the next, what do we got, 5 or 6 hours until game time. So maybe he'll play, but it seems they seem to be preparing for tonight's game, but the idea that he's not going to be playing.
This is a matchup with two teams that are really, really, really young. And do you feel like that's a storyline that's being underplayed with, you know, Ben Simmons, Brown, although hurt, and Tatum and Embiid all in one series?
Not necessarily, because these teams, like, their stars for the most part are young, although of course Al Horford is the elder statesman, but all these teams have, especially in the second half of the season, either added or increasingly relied on veterans to kind of round out their rotation. So for Boston, Marcus Morris has been playing a pretty huge role for them, and Shane Larkin's been a valuable deep bench guy. Aaron Baines is going to play a big role in the series. He has a lot of experience. And then for Philly, I mean, Marco Bellinelli, Ersan Ilyasova, and J.J. Redick have been really vital, and one of the main reasons why their offense has been so great in the second half of the season. So I don't think the whole youth and experience thing is going to be that much of an issue. I think we saw it a bit for the Celtics in the first round where Jason Tatum was pretty inconsistent throughout the series, finished with a bang, started with a bang, but kind of got lost in the middle there. Rozier up and down as well. That's what happens when you're young. You're not used to dealing with physicality of playoff defense. So Ben Simmons is probably going to have some issues early on in the series because Boston is so well equipped to defend him. Joel Embiid, if he's not hitting his mid-range jumper or three-point shot, he's going to have some troubles, but those guys are elite players. It's going to even out over the course of the series. I mean, we should be in for a pretty long battle here.
And you kind of touched on it, but just to expand on the point of Ben Simmons, the Celtics just had to deal with Giannis, you know, another kind of 6'10", 7'5", five-position guy. How does that experience, how does that game plan go into defending Simmons in this series, and how does Semi Ojeleye factor into that? We saw how big of a role he had down the stretch there in the Milwaukee series.
And I think it should continue. I mean, Giannis was a perfect warm-up for Simmons. It kind of is really the other way around. Simmons is a perfect warm-up for Giannis. I would say that the advantage for Simmons versus Giannis is that Giannis was forced into a lot of really difficult fadeaway jumpers, and he hit a lot of those. And that's how he really broke the Celtics back. Ben doesn't really hit any shots outside of 10 feet. He doesn't really hit any jump shots. Definitely doesn't hit those kind of shots. Semi Ojeleye would play, and Al Horford to a degree, played a huge role in stopping Giannis high, forcing him into fadeaways. Simmons doesn't really have that option. But while Giannis is a good playmaker, Simmons is already, I'd say, pretty close to an elite playmaker. So you can stop him at the free throw line. He's still probably going to find a way to make a play. And then, of course, you know, Milwaukee was trying to get it where either Giannis was getting deep and making plays or they were having someone else finding him in the interior so they could lob it up to him. But Simmons is the one handling the ball, and Joel will catch anything even remotely near the rim and put it in. So, I mean, it's definitely, I would say it's a lot trickier defending this team than it is defending Milwaukee, but Simmons, I think, is more containable than Giannis was.
And we're talking to Jared Weiss of The Athletic. Jared, you mentioned it. They played Giannis, who's kind of similar in play style to a guy like Ben Simmons. Do you think because of that, Joel Embiid's going to pose a bigger threat for the Celtics?
Yeah. I mean, Joel is – I just asked him about this. So the Celtics are well-equipped to defend him in the post between Horford and Baines and then maybe Monroe, we'll see, and maybe some of Semi Ojeleye. They have guys that can really wall him off when he tries to post up. He's not going to be able to back them down very easily. And the Celtics are well-equipped for that. The problem is they want to force him into taking contested mid-range jumpers. And I asked him about that. He said today that that's his go-to shot, that everybody knows it. The coaching staff reminds him that he says, at least I haven't checked the numbers, he says he's a 65% shooter on those shots, which is pretty damn good. So he wants that. If you know, the Celtics are trying to figure out how to pick their poison of what they want to force Joel into. There's not really a good option there. It's just really what's the least lethal poison. So, I mean, they do want him taking contested long or mid-range jump shots because that's pretty much the least valuable shot in the game, but it doesn't really matter what the value of the shot is that much if he's hitting them all. So he's the one guy where there's not, you know, Simmons, you can try to wall him off and force him to pass out the ball or take some shots. With Joel, there's no good option with him. He can pass out of a double team. He can either run pick and roll or be the roller or popper on a pick and roll. It's like he can do everything on the floor.
We know from the last series, Milwaukee, obviously, it was the story of the series. Terry Rozier, Eric Bledsoe, the bad blood between them. Do you see a similar storyline developing this series? And if so, who do you think ends up going at each other?
I feel like Rozier and Redick are probably going to get into it at some point. You know, those two are both very pretty feisty dudes. They like to grab and they like to, you know, throw guys in the screens a lot. So if they end up matching up on each other and chasing each other around, especially late in the game, I wouldn't be surprised to see something flare up between the two of those guys.
So should Boston fans be ready to chant Josh Redick, I guess, former Red Sox at the Garden?
That's a pretty good one. I mean, J.J. Redick's been used to the opposing crowds hating him forever since he was a Dookie, so I don't think it's going to affect him too much. I love him. He's one of my favorite players in the league. So he's going to be a handful. He's probably the least talked about of the major, you know, figures in Philly, but he can be the most lethal out of all those guys. He's one of the toughest covers in the entire game.
You mentioned Redick dealing with the crowd, and overall we saw how big home court was in the first round. Do you think that carries over here to the second round?
Sure. I mean, Ersan Ilyasova yesterday, I think, was talking about how in the Miami series, they would go down to Miami and half of the crowd would be there. And he knows that in Boston, they're going to show up and they're going to be screaming. I think he even said it's going to be wicked loud. So he knows what he's talking about. And yeah, I mean, the Boston crowd's intense. The Boston crowd has had a pretty strong effect on opposing teams in the playoffs for years. That doesn't change. I predicted last series it was going to be a 7-game series where the home team won every game, and that's exactly what happened. So I'm assuming that things are going to go in a pretty similar manner. The big difference in this series is not only does Philly probably have the upper hand entering into the series, but with Jalen maybe not playing tonight, or if so, playing kind of hurt, they have a good shot to take this first game here, and that gives them a huge upper hand in the series.
And we already talked about the youth on both of these teams heading into this series. They're going to be good for a while. At least that's what it looks like right now. Do you think we're going to look back on this series as maybe the starting point of a rivalry for years to come?
Definitely. I mean, these two teams should probably be in the conference finals for the next 5 or 6 years, most likely. So if all goes according to plan. So, yeah, this is going to be a great rivalry. I think once they once we started to see how good Embiid was turning out, and then we saw how good Simmons was just early, even before he got hurt last year, just like in summer league, stuff like that, I think it was clear that Philly was – that the process was kind of working. And then seeing what they did early this year, even before they went on that run, we knew that there was going to be something really special between these two teams. So the fact that we get to see it early on, this is kind of like bonus basketball for this rivalry. But these two teams are positioned to build dynasties for the next half decade plus. Probably even more than that. So they're going to be clashing for a long time. It's a really perfect NBA rivalry because it's got history. It's got two really obnoxious East Coast, you know, Northeast cities who love going at each other. So it's, you know, the fans are going to be vicious. The teams are going to play great basketball, and there's a lot of exciting players on the floor. So this is a perfect NBA rivalry.
Jared, I know you're up against it, but before we let you go, we got to get a series prediction from you here.
I've been saying Sixers and six. The more that I've looked at it, I think I would say Sixers and seven, depending on whether Jaylen Brown is healthy and effective tonight. So obviously it's impossible to tell. I'll just, since this is probably going to be the last time I'm predicting before the series starts, I'll say Sixers and seven.
All right. Well, we had Jimmy Murphy say Bruins and seven for the Toronto series, and the Bruins won that. So maybe it's good luck, people picking against Boston on our show. He is Jared Weiss. You can follow him on Twitter at JaredWeissNBA. You can read his work at The Athletic. Jared, thanks so much for taking the time today.
You know what? Bucks in six. That's my final prediction.
Ooh, all right.
Calling It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Thanks to Jared Weiss for talking Celtics with us. This is the Callin' It podcast, powered by CLNS. Alex Barth and Alex Lebowitz. And Lebowitz, I don't remember the last time. It's kind of unfortunate that the two teams in the playoffs are on at the same time. They normally try to stagger them.
Yeah, they do. And it's going to be tough to consume both and pay attention to both as much as you'd like. At least one of them is an hour before the other, so you'll be able to see the end of each game and prioritize in that sense.
So, again, like we said with the Celtics, because we are recording this Monday afternoon and we want the show to have a longer shelf life, with the Bruins, we're just going to kind of talk about the series, not necessarily get into specifics of where we're at after game one, because odds are by the time you listen to this, game two may be in the books as well. But what we saw from game one, you've got to be encouraged. The Bruins are just a team that's always kind of had Tampa's number, and you worried maybe if that Toronto series took a lot out of them. But they look like a team. They don't look like a team that's coming off a seven-game series. They look like a team that's coming off a sweep and is well-rested.
Yeah, they capitalized on scoring opportunities. They played very well. And definitely, you have to be encouraged with how they performed. I was worried. That first period, it was looking like each team was getting their shots. But Tampa was a little bit smoother. And then it kind of leveled out, and the Bruins went ahead. And one decision I look at is pulling the goalie, the Lightning, with like 6 or 7 minutes left. Don't really understand that, but the reality is the Bruins had control of that entire game, and that's definitely the start you're looking for, especially when you consider that they were on the road in game one, and it's just a big way to start the series off.
Well, no, they clearly have Tampa panicked. They're clearly in their heads pulling the goalie that early, and that's excellent. I mean, the first line, nobody wants to face the Bruins' first line right now. There's an argument to be made that they're the best line in hockey. In the playoffs, I think it's through the seven games in against Toronto and then the one in Tampa. There's something like plus 80. It's something absurd. They have like 43 points, and
they're plus four. The three in that first line: Bergeron, Marchand, and the fourth is
Pasternak.
Yeah. So yeah, or the third rather.
Yeah.
So yeah, they've been playing. I mean, it was like every shift they were on, I feel like they were scoring.
And remember last year, we've talked about this on the show before, but I just want to bring it up again. The Bruins had these players last year, but Claude Julien, for whatever reason, hated the idea of Pasternak being on that top line. Remember, he wanted him to have his own line on the second line. He kept putting these scrubs up with Marchand and Bergeron, and we were calling for them, put talent with talent. And it's nice to see the Bruins finally doing what 29, now 30, other NHL teams do. And grouping their talent together. And it makes you wonder what this team could have been last year. But again, a great start to them against Tampa Bay. Who knows? Maybe they lose tonight. Maybe that sounds a little weird on Tuesday. But let's talk about Tuukka Rask, a subject I know you love very much. save percentage in Game 7, still below 90. He wasn't. What did you think of him in Game 7 against Toronto? What did you think?
He was all right. I mean, he hasn't been out of his mind at all. He hasn't been playing like you're used to seeing Bruins goalies play in the playoffs.
I mean, we've all been spoiled by Tim Thomas. That's kind of what sucks for Tuukka Rask, is he will always be compared to 2011 Tim Thomas. And nobody's ever doing that again.
No. And the reason they won, it wasn't because of him. It was because of clutch play.
You're talking about Game 7.
In Game 7. Yeah. It was because of the clutch play and scoring when it really mattered. And, yeah, he made saves down the stretch. But overall, yeah, he needs to pick up his game. And I thought Game 1 he did that.
Yeah, I just think Toronto's a team that's always been in his head.
Yeah.
And I do expect a better series from him overall against Tampa Bay. And not only did he play okay in Game 1, he played okay on the road. Which, that's really been his issue in the playoffs. He's been okay at home, but once he gets on the road, he has his issues. And to see him relatively hold Tampa on the road was refreshing. Now, we'll see what he does in Game 2. Again, it's the problem with recording the show only once a week. But he seems to be playing into both camps right now, both the Tuukka defenders and the Tuukka haters. Because some of those goals he let in Game 1 probably shouldn't have gone in. But at the same time, he did enough and he got them the win. And that's always kind of been the argument. Is he a good goalie? Is he a great goalie? The one big issue I had with him in Game 1, and it's the player everybody's talking about, is when his skate blade fell off.
Yeah.
Now, I've gotten a couple different answers from hockey people. Like, people who I trust have given me different answers that, because the rule is if a player loses a skate blade, you don't stop play for that. But the rule also is if a goalie has an equipment issue, you have to stop play right away. And nobody seems to know which rule takes precedent there. Because it's an equipment issue. It's a player losing a skate, but it's the goalie losing a skate. It's an equipment issue. But without a skate, I mean, you're not going to make a save if you're a Tuukka Rask.
No.
At that point, I would have rather seen him either throw his mask off or knock the net off the moorings. If you take a 2-minute delay of game penalty, fine. Because I think you're better off trying to kill that penalty than having a goalie with one skate blade. I think he panicked in that instance, and that was not encouraging.
And if that's the worst that happens with Tuukka, it's fine. I doubt that's going to happen again in the playoffs. Yeah, maybe he could have handled it differently, but like, how often is a goalie really confronted with that situation? I'm not going to fault him too much. You know, hindsight's 20/20. I thought overall he still kept his cool, and you mentioned it. Game on the road, he showed up. The Bruins showed up, and they set the tone for the series.
And then after Game 2 on Monday night, they will return back to Boston. And who knows? I mean, the way Tampa was their obstacle, right?
Yeah.
The thing was, if they could get past Tampa, they realistically have a chance to win the whole thing. Vegas has looked good. San Jose's looked good. But, I'm not that worried about the Penguins. I don't know if you are. I don't think they're going to play the Capitals. I don't.
History tells us probably not.
Right. The Capitals aren't going to win that series. You have to feel pretty good right now about the Bruins' long-term chances.
Absolutely. And you know, I don't think they're back in that full-on mid-season form, you know, when we saw them at their peak.
But I don't know if they need to be right now.
Maybe not. Maybe they need to save it. Who knows? But I think they're closer than that than they were towards the end of the season. You know, last round, it was bumpy. They maybe lost some games they shouldn't have. They let in goals that they shouldn't have. And they played lackadaisical when they probably shouldn't have. That game one set the tone. And I feel like it was a good bounce back, to get them to playing the way that we were used to seeing them play.
So we'll see. There's a good chance. Not a good chance. There's a chance that next show we do, we'll be previewing the Eastern Conference Finals with the Bruins. It could happen. Or we'll be talking about a great series between the Bruins and the Penguins.
It's the Penguins, yeah.
All right. Other event over the weekend, NFL draft. You know we got to touch on that. Give us 30 seconds to pay the bills. We'll be right back. This is Callin' It, powered by CLNS.
Callin' It is brought to you by American Broadcast Coaches, training the next generation of media talent and communicators. For more information, check out AmericanBroadcastCoaches.com.
Welcome back to Calling It. Can't talk, not talk about the NFL draft. This is primarily a football show, let's be honest.
Yeah, this is the first NFL draft I've been excited for in 3 years, I'd say. 3 years, two first round picks, five in the first three rounds.
Needed
going
a
into
quarterback
it.
That kept things intriguing
for sure. Yeah,
and we'll get into that in a little bit. But let's recap real quick the Patriots weekend. Alex Lovitz, go ahead.
Okay, so in the first round, the Patriots with pick number 23 drafted Isaiah Wynn, offensive lineman out of Georgia.
Yep.
And pick number 31, Sony Michel, running back, another Bulldog out of Georgia. Second round, a lot of action here. With pick number 43,
nope,
they traded to the Detroit Lions for picks number 51 and 117.
So then, what'd they do at 51? They got 51. What'd they do
at
51?
And then they didn't pick anyone.
All right, they traded that too, I guess.
They traded that for two more picks, number 105 and a 2019 second rounder. That was for the Bears. That could be a top 10 pick.
That could be a decent pick. Okay.
Top 10 in the second round, that is. Pick number 56, they did use this one. Duke Dawson, cornerback, the slot specialist out of Florida.
And I wanted to talk more about that pick, but let's finish the recap.
Pick number 63, trade it to the Bucks.
So that's, just to be clear, that's three picks in the top 100 they've now traded.
Their first six picks that they had, they traded three of them. And they got, there you go, ka-ching. They got number 117 for pick number 56. So number 56, to go back, that was traded. They traded up for that. Not used to seeing that out of the Patriots. Third round, pick number 95. They traded that one. Offensive lineman Trent Brown from the 49ers. Friend of the Patriots, evidently. And they also got pick number 143 for that as well. Fourth round, 105. They traded that one to the Cleveland Browns. They moved down nine spots and then got 178 on top of that. Pick number 114. Traded that one to the Detroit Lions for a 2019 third round pick. Okay, now here we go. This is pick number 117. That was involved in the trade for Dawson back in the second round. Okay, fifth round, they used their pick. They used pick number 143. There we go. To draft Juwan Bentley, linebacker out of Purdue.
To be confused with Juwan Purdue, linebacker out of Bentley.
Of course. And then sixth round, they used this pick as well, their first one at least, 178. Drafted Christian Sam, linebacker out of Arizona State, ASU. Pick number 198, traded it to the Kansas City Chiefs for 2 7th rounders, number 233 and 243.
Nothing like turning a six into 2 7ths, baby.
And then pick number 210, this is probably the most popular pick of the draft. They got Braxton Berrios, wide receiver out of Miami. One of the greatest names in the draft, if you ask me, by the way. Seventh round.
And he's gonna wear number 10, so it's going to be Brax 10 Berrios.
Oh, there you go. Number in the seventh round, pick number 219, your favorite pick of the draft, Danny Etling, quarterback, LSU.
We'll get into that.
Pick number 233, traded to the Philadelphia Eagles for number 250 and a 2019 seventh rounder. Pick number 249, this is in the seventh round, Keon Cross in cornerback, Western Carolina. And then to round it all off with pick number 250, Ryan Izzo, tight end, Florida State. And they also had a bunch of undrafted free agents, undrafted rookies they signed. Probably most notably would be Ralph Webb out of Vanderbilt. I think he is one of the leading rushers in that school's history.
So, all right. So, there's all the names. Honestly, we just wanted to use the buzzer effect for all the trades. That's why we went through all that. Wynn, Michelle, Dawson, Trent Brown, they traded for Bentley, Sam, Berrios, Etling, and Izzo. Let's start in the first round. I think Isaiah Wynn, look, it's easy to say the first guy they picked was the best pick of the draft, but that was their best pick of the draft. He can compete for a starting tackle job. If not, he gives them flexibility inside. Shaq Mason's in the last year of his contract. He's a guy who could start. And they needed a guy who's going to come in, put his head down, and do his job, and not ruffle any feathers. They got everything that they needed. They checked every box with Isaiah Wynn, I think.
Yeah, he's a versatile offensive lineman. Will he be able to fill that left tackle void? I don't know, but he'll be a contributing factor on that O-line. And someone who, you know, by all accounts, is an NFL-ready prospect. I have no problems with that pick. It fills the void, and I think that they got the value right.
Then they go to Sony Michel with the 31st pick. A lot of people, I mean, I was in this room. We did the CLNS draft night live in this room. And I remember looking up at the big board thinking, Lamar Jackson's there, Lamar Jackson's there. They pass on Lamar Jackson. He actually goes with the next pick. But they took Sony Michel. I have mixed feelings about this. Last time they took a running back in the first round, the only other running back Bill has taken in the first round is Lawrence Maroney. Now, yeah, Lawrence Maroney was bad. He was just really bad at football. I don't know how else to put it. That's not the last time I'm going to say that today. But there was a run on running backs at the beginning of the second round. They wouldn't have gotten their pick of the guy they wanted if they waited. Michelle's ceiling is probably Deion Lewis. He reminds me a lot of Deion Lewis if he can stay healthy and hold on to the football. Now, those are some big ifs. But Belichick, there's a clear pattern here. First pick was a clear replacement for Nate Solder. Second pick was a clear replacement for Deion Lewis. And the third pick, Duke Dawson, was a clear replacement for Malcolm Butler. There's a pattern here. And look, there was no running back more similar to Deion in the draft. So in that aspect, I like the pick. Maybe a bit of a reach, but given what happened on day two, it makes a lot more sense in hindsight.
Yeah, you know what? I'm in the camp of being against drafting a running back in the first round, especially when you have the history of doing the running back
Lawrence
by committee.
Maroney. Thing.
And Lawrence Maroney, yeah. Of course. And they've had success drafting guys, running backs in the second, third, fourth round. Shane Vereen, Stephen Ridley. You could have waited. You could have waited, and I feel like there were bigger voids on this team that needed to be filled. They have talent at the running back position, and they're not a team that relies on the run all that much. You could have gone elsewhere, and that's my biggest problem. Will Sony Michel be good? Yeah, probably. If he can become an Alvin Kamara type, I would be for
the
pick.
That's that name we keep hearing, right? That's that name that people keep dangling in front of us is Alvin Kamara.
But the only problem is, from what I saw, he wasn't much of a threat in the passing game at Georgia. Again, it's college compared to the pros. Maybe he can evolve and be that guy. But I don't know. I don't know if it was worth the 31st pick in the draft.
So I have similar feelings about their next pick. That was in the second round, Duke Dawson. They traded down, then traded back up to take him. Cornerback out of Florida, slot corner. Not a bad player. Good slot corner, but a slot corner who has trouble with tackling. And any Patriots fan should be nauseous even thinking about that concept after the Super Bowl. A guy, again, decent player. He is a lot of what they like. He can play zone. He can body guys up at the line of scrimmage. But they probably could have gotten him around later. They could have taken somebody else that they needed there in the second round, somebody else who would have helped the team, and then taken Dawson in the third. So, like the player, not a huge fan of the pick.
Yeah, I think it fills a void. It's good in that sense. I don't know if he's going to be a standout. But I will say this. I think the way they traded in the second round, I did like. I think they got a lot of value for what they did trade.
Okay.
And Dawson's included in that.
So real quick, because we're trying to fly through these, but do you think Belichick was purposely trading to muddy up the Garoppolo result?
No. That goes against everything he's ever done.
But hasn't this whole offseason gone against everything he's ever done? Isn't that the whole point of this offseason?
Because he wants to do what's best for the Patriots for the most part. Obviously, he has that selfish thing where he can be spiteful. I don't think he'd go as far as to trade, you know, a 43rd pick in the draft simply to erase something that he might feel regret over.
You mentioned being spiteful. Put a bookmark in that. They didn't pick again until the fifth round. They punted on the third and fourth. Well, the third they traded for Trent Brown. Good player. We'll talk about him come training camp. I'm going to group these two together. Juwan Bentley, Christian Sam, linebackers out of Purdue and Arizona State. Sam's interesting to me because he can play special teams. He can move around a little bit. Juwan Bentley tells me that Landon Roberts is not making the team because they're the exact same player. And make of that what you will, that they've drafted another Landon Roberts. First ever three-time captain at Purdue. And once you hear that, you knew the Patriots were drafting him.
Yeah. There's a lot of question marks at the linebacker position. Are they going to get rid of a Landon Roberts? I don't think he was all that bad last year. I think, you know, obviously Kyle Van Noy was the most consistent guy they had in that linebacking core with Dante Hightower out. But with Hightower coming back, this gives them some flexibility. What do they do with the rest of those guys? And it definitely makes you think that one of the guys in that group is not going to make the roster. Who's the weak link? There's no Shea McClellan anymore. It's probably Landon Roberts.
Probably Robert. And again, I still don't think if they have a chance at 23, if he's still on the board, I think they take Rashawn Evans from Alabama.
Definitely.
I think they got jumped on that I'm happy with picking Wynn, but they still did not do enough to address the middle linebacker need. I don't think either of these guys would do it. A couple good special teams players, projects, but nobody was helping them win this year. This was a great pick at 210 at the back end of the sixth round. Braxton Berrios out of Miami. I mean, this one you saw coming a mile away. Small slot receiver.
Up for the academic high. What's the equivalent of the academic
high? They took three guys who received the outstanding academic award in their conference. Braxton Berrios, Juwan Bentley, and we'll get into the other one next. I don't even want to say his name. But anyway, Berrios, excellent punt returner, can play the slot. He has the potential to be Danny Amendola in terms of playing style and Edelman in terms of the numbers, I think. They didn't take Brady's replacement in this draft. They may have taken Edelman's.
Yeah, definitely. They add some depth to that wide receiving core. I don't think they necessarily need it, but this is a guy.
And that's going to be a fight at that position in camp, because remember, they signed Jordan Matthews. They have Kenny Britt coming back. They have Malcolm Mitchell coming back from injury. Those spots are going to be hard to get on this team.
Absolutely. And more than that, the reps will be hard to get. Who's going to be his favorite targets without Amendola and Cooks? Those are two top receivers
right.
Brady doesn't have this year.
He'll have Edelman.
He'll have Edelman. Yeah, Edelman will be back, so that fills one of those right. One of those spots. But I love this move. I know it's unoriginal too, but this guy just seems like the prototypical Patriot. So I'm optimistic. And just to go back to your point, just because you were good academically in college won't necessarily translate. Jordan Richards is a guy who was always considered the smartest guy on the field. He knew everyone's assignment. He stinks.
Right.
So who knows how it's going to turn out? And I know the next guy who you mentioned was one of the academics.
And I will say this first. Talk about academic success in college not translating. I mean, we went to college together. I feel safe saying this. We missed our fair share of classes, and I think we're doing okay in the real world. So
yeah,
just a few. There were a few times we would call games instead of going to class. But
more than a few, yeah.
First pick in the seventh round, Danny Etling out of LSU was all academic, and it really ends there. The guy may have been the worst quarterback in the SEC. He's not good. He's not good. He got benched by noted quarterback factory LSU, right? If you're a fan of Matt Flynn and Jamarcus Russell, and of course I've got to bring up Rohan Davey.
Oh, yeah.
I hate – look, I know it's seventh round pick. I know he's probably just a camp arm. He's got the frame for a quarterback. I understand why they drafted him. But the fact that there's a point, one chance that Danny Etling starts a regular season game for the New England Patriots scares the hell out of me. He's really, really bad. Like, his pre-snap ability is okay. He came from a pro-style offense, so he understands that. But go watch him throw the football. He is constantly, constantly missing receivers.
You see, I watched his game film. And this is one of the guys, this is the only guy in the seventh round that they picked that I actually looked up his game film. Because he's a quarterback. There's the intrigue there. I didn't think he was all that bad. I think the offensive line at LSU was horrendous. Didn't give him a lot of time. And he had a decent arm.
I think he asked for too much time from his offensive line. He's hesitant to pull the trigger. He has a good arm in terms of strength, but he uses it too much. He overthrows guys a lot. I don't see it. And let me ask this, and you talk about Bill being spiteful. Is this him going to McDaniels and Kraft and even Brady and saying, I found the guy, I groomed him, you traded him. Here's the worst quarterback I could find. Groom this guy. All right? Jimmy's not good enough? Make this guy work.
That's Dr. Evil stuff.
He is the worst quarterback. He should not have been drafted. Danny Etling should not have been drafted.
You see, I think, I don't know. I looked up his film. I didn't think he was all that bad. And I think there's talent there, and it's salvageable. So we'll see. You could be wrong. Brady was 199. I don't think anyone thought he was going to be any good. Not saying this guy's the next Brady, but there is the unexpected.
Brady had different issues than Etling does, and it was a different time.
What were his issues compared to Etling's?
Brady just did everything too slow. He could make all the throws. He could make the reads. He just wasn't quick enough.
Yeah.
Etling, his footwork is a mess. He does not have great accuracy. He does not have accuracy necessary for the NFL. Etling might make a good coach. He clearly understands the game. I'll give him that. His football IQ is high. But I just don't think he has the arm to be an NFL quarterback.
What were his targets like at LSU? How is their wide receiving core?
Oh, I mean, LSU just pumps out wide receiver after receiver. He had underclassmen this year, but I'm sure they're guys that in 2 or 3 years are going to be NFL talent.
He also had Fournette.
He had a defenses keyed in on the running game, so he was not a guy defenses keyed in on. Not a great pick. Final two, Keon Crossan out of Western Carolina. If you want to learn about this guy, don't go to NFL.com because they did not have a write-up on him. they did not project him. They threw something up after the pick that projected him as needing time in a developmental league. So Bill took an XFL prospect.
He's got a great
freak
XFL
athlete.
Name.
He's a freak athlete. He's 40 times great. He's got like a 42-inch vertical. Don't think he makes the team. And then Ryan Izzo. I like Ryan Izzo, the tight end out of Florida State. Good blocker. Has the ability to develop as a receiver later on. If he sticks as the third tight end, that's a good pick, and they'll get value out of it. He can block.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I don't know either of these guys all that well. Seventh round throwaway picks. They make the roster. They make the roster. I'm not too optimistic though.
One more draft thing. You're surprised they passed on a quarterback.
No, I think that just tells me that they didn't think the guy was there, and there are bigger needs for the team in the immediate future. The only way they were going to risk taking a guy in the first 2-3 rounds was if they thought he was the next starter for the Patriots. He wasn't there. Maybe he was. He was just picked, you know, in the top 20. So, I think they made a decision based off of what was available, and there just wasn't the guy that they were looking for.
Drew Locke. Remember that name next year. Drewlock, quarterback from Missouri. He broke all the SEC passing records last year. I think he would have been the second best quarterback in this draft had he come out. He decided to wait since the class was so strong. He wants to be the number one overall pick. Now, look, he could have a down year this year at Missouri. Maybe he won't be the top pick. Maybe there'll be somebody else who ends up being the top pick instead. But with all the assets, look, I'm not a huge fan of them trading down as much as they did, but if they did so to acquire assets to move up next year and take either Drew Locke or Will Greer out of West Virginia, it's worth it. Because one of those two guys, in my mind, should be Brady's heir apparent.
Yeah, and they're going to have three picks in the first two rounds. So they'll have assets to move up if they want to. Not that they ever do. But they have flexibility, and we'll see what they do.
Drew Locke, baby. M-I-Z-Z-O-U. That's going to do it for us this week. More playoff talk next week. We didn't touch on the Red Sox much because they had kind of an ant week, but we'll get into them. Again, same time Monday. Show will be up in the afternoon. Follow us on Twitter at Collinet Podcast and check us out online, clnsmedia.com. For Alex Lovewitz, I'm Alex Barth. Let's go Celtics. Let's go Bruins. Let's go Red Sox. Talk to you next week.